On the 29th of November 2011, a group of Iranian students, angry at what they claimed was Britain's anti-Iran policy, entered the British Embassy in Tehran.
It damaged the relationship with Britain hugely.
Although deemed unjustifiable by both sides, the attack demonstrated the anger felt by Iranians towards Britain.
Disagreement with that accent shouldn't mislead us to forget about British wrongdoing in Iran.
I think they do nonetheless need to acknowledge their role.
Can the two countries put their troubled past behind them and enjoy a good relationship in the future?
The only guide to the future is the past, but you should not be trapped by the past.
Iran and Britain have been far from the friendliest countries in the world. Their history of distrust goes back many decades.
مردم ایران به خصوص در دو سه قرن اخیر نسبت به کشورهایی که به هر حال دخالت در امور داخلی کشورمون داشتن به طور طبیعی یه برداشت منفی دارن. طبیعی هم هست. به خصوص انگلیس که در 100 سال اخیر واقعا دخالت‌های جدی در کشور ما داشت باعث شد که به هر حال ما حداقل در تاریخ معاصرمون با یک وقفه جدی در امر دموکراسی سازی کشور روبرو بشیم.
On the whole, British people are not aware of the way that some people in Iran view the United Kingdom, that most people here haven't got a clue about the history. And, for example, people are not aware of the fact that there are these common phrases in Persian, in Farsi, that it must be the English, or behind every curtain there's an Englishman, under every rock there's an Englishman, that kind of we're to blame. And I understand the history of those phrases.
The attack on the British Embassy in Tehran is the latest chapter in the series of historical events that have put the two nations at odds with each other. The main reason behind the attack was the reaction of Britain to a document published by the International Atomic Energy Agency. This document detailed certain weaponization elements within Iran's nuclear program, something Iran strongly denied.
Nuclear energy has a very important part in our economic development. Yes, we are an oil and gas producing country, but it doesn't mean that we have to consume all of them and leave nothing for the future generations. Based on our previous experiences, we don't want to be in a situation anymore in which we have to extend our hands towards others and begging for fuel, begging for our needs. So we decided to be self-sufficient in this important technology. We decided to be self-sufficient on fuel fabrication, so nobody can play with us anymore in the future. Nobody can deprive us from our needs in the future anymore.
Quick to respond to the report, Britain boycotted Iran's central bank, something that was seen by Iranians as just little short of declaration of war.
در تهران حضور داشته باشه و اینها در خط مقدم مقابله با منافع ملی جمهوری اسلامی ایران در همه عرصه ها بیشتاز باشن.
مصوبه ای رو در مجلس گذروندیم با توجه به مجموعه مواضع بسیار منفی انگلیس علیه ملت ما، نقش انگلیس در وضع تحریم‌های جدید فراغتنامه‌ای. تصمیم گیری شد در مجلس قبل که ما سطح رابطه رو از سفیر تنزل بدیم به کاردار.
در زمانی که این اتفاق افتاد فضا فضای منفی و سلبی نسبت به انگلیس بود، برای اینکه بحث تحریم ها شروع شده بود به طور جدی و انگلیس پیشتاز این مسئله تحریم شده بود، یعنی دلیل نداشت حالا انگلیس بخواد اینقدر پیشتازی بکنه. این یک اثر بسیار منفی در اذهان مردم گذاشت با توجه به سابقه انگلیس در کشور ما. دیدن که باز انگلیس ظاهراً درس از و عبرت از گذشته نگرفته. انگلیس اون موقع خیلی فضاسازی کرد و جزو اولین کشورهایی بود که گفت ما میخواییم تحریم بکنیم، چیکار بکنیم، اله بکنیم. افکار مردم واقعاً دیگه قابلیت پذیرش بیمنطقی رو از جانب یک دولت استعمارگری که سابقه بدی هم تو کشور داشت نداشتن. خلاصه این به هیجان افتادن و این هیجان باعث شد که برن به سمت سفارت و سفارت رو اشغال بکنن.
Unsatisfied with the downgrade of relations, students from several Tehran universities protested by gathering in front of the British Embassy compound near Tehran's Ferdowsi Square for several days, demanding the full closure of the embassy.
The embassy itself has become very much a kind of focal point for this sort of, you know, collective distrust of, you know, British involvement in Iranian affairs.
Only the arrival of the chief of the Tehran police could calm the situation and helped evacuate the protesters out of the embassy compound. The breach into the embassy happened when the Iranian foreign minister, Ali Akbar Salahi, was away on a diplomatic mission. The news was broken to him in a rather awkward situation.
من در زمان اشغال سفارت جده بودم. یکی از بندهای جلسه خیلی جالبه، مربوط به حمله به سفارتخانه های کشورها در دمشق بود. من وقتی که عازم بودم به اون جلسه، یه دفعه به من اطلاع دادن که سفارت انگلیس در تهران اشغال شد. اصلا این دفعه واقعا خیلی یکی خوردم، یعنی تعجب کردم. حالا من دارم واسه چی میرم و الان یه همچین اتفاق تو کشور خودم افتاده.
این چنین حادثه‌ای طبیعتاً غیر قابل قبول و حادثه‌ای بود که به هیچ وجه نباید اتفاق میافتاد. به همین دلیل هم جمهوری اسلامی ایران در بالاترین سطح که شخص مقام معظم رهبری بودن نسبت به این مسئله واکنششون دادن.
Iran's leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei reacted to the event by stating that although the sentiments of the youth were justified, entering the embassy was not right.
شاید در کمتر مسئله مقام معظم رهبری مراتب ناخرسندی خودشون رو اعلام میکنن، ولی در جبه این واقع اعلام فرمودند چون ما طبیعتاً مسئولیت داریم در ارتباط با حفظ امنیت همه سفارتخانه‌های خارجی در تهران، حتی اگر با اون دولت هم رابطه خوبی نداشته باشیم و کشور ما هم از ضریب امنیتی بسیار بالایی برخورداره و چنین وقایعی بسیار نادر ممکن اتفاق بیفته.
With all the diplomats from around the globe lining up to condemn the attack, one important message was lost in the heat of the event. The anger towards Britain has deep roots within the hearts of many Iranians, something that must be understood if the two countries are to avoid similar troubles in the future.
Whether every notion about the British government that exists among ordinary Iranians is valid or not is debatable. But there isn't really a doubt, I think, that the Iranians have serious grievances with regards to British policy, both in the past and in more recent years. And that the British government has traditionally played a very harmful role in Iran.
The roots of mistrust that we see, you know, manifesting themselves today are very much derived in large part from this very fraught relationship that's gone on over the course of the past century or indeed more. And I think certainly, you know, when one examines the way in which both the British see the Iranians and the Iranians see the British, it's very much colored by this tense relationship, particularly since the sort of 1890s and early 1900s.
I'm someone who's always sought to understand the Iranian perspective on relations with Britain. And I worked very hard when I was Foreign Secretary, and I've actually worked hard since I left as Foreign Secretary in 2006 to try to comprehend Iran and its complex history, its difficult, sometimes difficult relationship with the United Kingdom.
The 19th century saw British interest towards Iran grow as part of their plans for imperial expansion. For Europe, Iran was the gateway to the East, and controlling this gateway would ensure an easy reach to important countries like India and China.
Iran, because of its strategic position, became extremely important for what was called the great game between the United Kingdom and the jewel in the crown of the United Kingdom's empire, which was India. And bear in mind, India went right to the Afghanistan border on the west. And Russia, which was seen as highly expansionist, and against whom Britain and France and Turkey had fought a big war in the 1850s. So that meant that Britain was heavily involved in Iran.
You can find many events and many elements in Iranian history, especially in 19th and 20th century, that first of 20th century at least, that the British government tried to be involved in every aspect of Iranian life. If you look at the British official documents at the National Archives, British National Archives, and the Indian Office Library, or especially in BP archives in Warwick University, Anglo-Persian Iranian Company documents, you can see that the British government and the British officials and agents were involved in many details of Iranian life.
With all the interest in Iran, Britain did not even attempt to colonize it, for it was a mission impossible, but rather opted to exercise neo-colonial power.
There are many examples to show that neo-colonial power, with the practice but not the legality of colonial power, are actually worse for a country than colonial power. Because at least if there's colonial power, as there was in India, we had to take some responsibility as well. But we didn't have to take responsibility. It was a kind of exploitative relationship. Because Britain was so much more powerful than Iran, it was the superpower of the 19th century, it was able also to exercise a lot of financial power. And so it was through that financial power and through the fact that the Qajar dynasty had to borrow money from British banks that Britain built up this extraordinary situation where in Iran, where, for example, there was the monopoly granted to Baron Julius de Reuters, which was a monopoly to a single foreigner, a Brit, to build and run railways, canals, and large parts of industry for a tiny amount of money in return.
The concession to Reuters from the Qajar dynasty was so immense that even imperialists like Lord Curzon characterized it as the most complete grant of resources ever by any country to a foreigner.
Baron Julius de Reuter and his saga was quite important and sad part of the Iranian history. That again was a symbol of expansionism and the colonial feeling of the British government and British and people who were related to British government, that they were trying to add Iran to their own colonial and imperialistic attitudes in the region. If you look at the region, you can see at that time Iran was the only independent government that never became part of the British colonies or imperialism, although the Iranian government was very much under influence of British government, but never been under 100% under their control.
Perhaps the greatest watershed moment in the history of the two countries took place towards the end of the 19th century, when Nasir ad-Din Shah granted Britain full monopoly over the production, sale and export of tobacco.
In one of his trip to to Europe and visiting the United Kingdom, Nasruddin Shah agreed to give the monopolizing of the tobacco activities and tobacco trade in Iran to a British company. This matter was firstly against the Iranian national interest and against the interest of the Iranian merchants.
The tobacco monopoly gave Major Talbot complete monopoly over the production, manufacture and export of tobacco products. And as you know, it was that really, the popular opposition to that, which led to the first really big uprising in which the leadership was both ordinary people and bazaaris, but also crucially the ulama as well, the clerics coming together.
Unfortunately, most of the British diplomats at the time interpreted it as effectively a kind of revival of Islamic fanaticism. They didn't understand that it was in fact a coalition, of course, between bazaari or merchant interests and indeed clerical or ulama interests, and that these were coming together and represented a kind of nascent nationalist movement.
1917 marked the start of one of the darkest periods in modern Iranian history, when the flames of World War I reached the Middle Eastern country and resulted in a disastrous famine that almost halved Iran's population. A famine that was far from natural.
Although Persia, Iran was a former neutral state, it was a battleground. And of course it had been occupied by first the Russians and the British, who divided it between them, and then after the Russian Revolution by the British. And the famine which took place in 1917 and 18, some 40% of the population, perhaps 10 million people dying, a truly shocking figure, was not a natural famine. It was a consequence of war. Essentially, yes, there were problems, but for instance, Britain prohibited the importation of food from India or from the United States. We were prepared to give that food because they didn't really want to reveal the true extent of what was going on. It was a consequence of the British forces themselves taking food from the Iranians to feed their own armies. So it wasn't a natural famine, it was an artificial famine in large extent.
The recent release of US military records and British official documents reveal the extent of Britain's role in causing this great calamity.
در اون اسناد تصریح شده که نیروهای انگلیسی گندم ایران رو با قیمت بالایی می‌خریدن که بفرستن برای نیروهاشون در خارج از کشور و در منطقه. خب این یه ظلم بسیار آشکاری بود در اون شرایط ویژه جنگ جهانی و موجب شد که ما در تعداد قابل توجهی از استانهامون و شهرهای بزرگمون قحطی ظهور و بروز پیدا بکنه. و این در خاطر پیرمردها وجود داشت و همینطور نسل به نسل هم بالاخره این ماجراها جدای از اسناد تاریخی تصریح شده به خصوص اسنادی که خود وزارت خارجه انگلیس منتشر کرده اون اثر منفی خودش رو طبیعتاً میذاره.
In the early 19th century, the world started to realize the importance of oil for industrial and military purposes. The British extracted yet another concession, through which they obtained the rights to almost the entire oil reserves of Iran in return for a disgraceful sum of only £20,000. This led to the establishment of the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, known today as British Petroleum.
Winston Churchill, when he was the Navy Minister in the second decade of the 20th century, from 1911 onwards, he decided that all of our battleships should be fueled by oil, not by coal, for it was more efficient, and so on. And one of the major oil fields was that owned by the Darcy Petroleum Company in Iran. Now, the moment he decided that we needed to run our battleships with oil, not coal, Iran and those southern oil fields in Iran became of crucial strategic importance. So it was just imperative for us to run Iran, regardless of what the Iranians thought about it, I'm afraid.
It was a British asset. It explored and developed the oil resources of Iran, which Britain, as a strong imperial power at the time, wanted for its own purposes. History changed, the world developed, Iran was becoming more assertive of itself and wanted to have its own resources for its own purposes.
Britain was now much more concerned about the stability of Iran because of their reliance on the country's vast oil reserves. They needed a strong pro-British figure to lead Iran and crush the spread of communism within the country. This led to a British-backed coup d'etat in 1921 that brought Reza Shah, the founder of Iran's last monarchy, to power.
By 1921, 1922, they were very worried about communism, they saw Bolshevism spreading. There had been this very popular revolution in 1912 for democracy. Actually, some of those ideas impacted into Iran from Russia. So they were very nervous about this, about the spread of left-wing ideas. But they also had a problem. Britain was now far overextended. It was fighting a serious guerrilla war in Ireland. It was fighting a rebellion in, as I say, what's now Iraq, a very serious rebellion. There was serious unrest in 1919 in Egypt. Things were getting out of hand in India, where the First World War led to the independence movement taking place. There was not enough British troops to go around. And the solution they seized upon in 1922 was handing power in Iran, effectively to this military strongman, the Pahlavi dynasty, and finding it. A reliant anti-communist figure who was going to crush the Majlis, going to crush the democracy inside Iran and stabilize it. This is what Britain wanted. So Britain, if you like, this is one of the first instances of Britain and later on the United States, not, you know, looking for a policy of not direct intervention, but finding a local ally who they could rely on to police the region for them. And of course, we know that the dynasty was a certain hiccup during the Second World War, but the dynasty survived into 1979 and played that role first for the British and then for the Americans.
Decades into the rule of the Pahlavi dynasty, Iranians had lost all hope for independence. Only in 1953 there came a glimmer of hope. An Iranian politician, unhappy with what he regarded as the plunder of his country's oil by the British, rose to power with huge national mandate and intent on nationalizing Iranian oil to the benefit of Iranian people. That man was Iran's democratically elected Prime Minister, Dr. Mohammad Mossadegh.
Mossadegh is very much a man of his time, and having witnessed, of course, British interventions in Iranian domestic politics over the course of his life, he was understandably wary of British involvement in the country through such through such vehicles as the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company. And so in some sense, he did have a kind of paranoia about the British, but it was a paranoia that was certainly understandable given the historical context and given Britain's interventions in Iran.
Mossadegh, I think, is a very interesting man from what I've read of him, and quite aristocratic, quite distant, educated in, I think, France and Switzerland, largely. But he didn't like the British, at an emotional level, he didn't like the British. And we somehow didn't get on with him. But he was elected as Prime Minister. He had a democratic mandate. And he sought to nationalise the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company because we were taking so much money, which was really the Iranian people's. And that led to a crisis, and in the end, now well documented, to the British intelligence service and the American intelligence service, conspiring with a lot of elements within Iran itself to have him removed and placed under house arrest.
The British had to either play fair and witness the end of their fortunes in Iran, or somehow get rid of this man and his nationalistic ideas. It was an easy choice to make at the time, with the British intelligence service soon called into action.
Despite there not having been an official acknowledgement by the British government. One can go to the National Archives and certainly find traces of the original plan for the coup, which was essentially conceived by the British, initially, of course, as Operation Boot. It then gets rebranded as Operation Ajax after the Americans essentially take over operational control of it, but it's essentially conceived of by the British.
The British involvement in Iran and their influence towards the press, national opinion, in the parliament and in different towns in Iran was very important and significant. They spent a lot of money for coup d'etat. The British agents and officials managed to convince the Americans that Mossadegh is not negotiable. And that was very helpful to have a coalition between the new conservative government of the United Kingdom as well as the new Republican government of the United States.
The coup d'etat to overthrow Mossadegh's government took place on the 19th of August 1953 through CIA and MI6 engineered protests and bribery of Iranian officers.
If one looks at the kind of paper trail, there are a number of individuals who I suppose are influential in helping the sort of genesis of the coup, notably Christopher Woodhouse, an MI6 agent, but also Anne Lambton, who was, of course, a scholar of Persian studies, was employed by the Foreign Office for a time as well. So it's this group of individuals in the Foreign Office and indeed MI6 who eventually, of course, go on to essentially influence or perhaps prey upon American communist paranoia, particularly so that the Americans eventually, of course, decide to implement the operation after the British are expelled from the country by Dr. Mossadegh, on the grounds, of course, that they are in fact plotting to overthrow him.
This has rankled ever since with ordinary Iranians, seeing it as an unacceptable interference in the affairs of their country. For most people in this country, that's not only not a distant memory, it's something that most people know nothing about.
For decades after the overthrow of Mossadegh, Britain enjoyed having Mohammad Reza Shah ruling Iran, supporting him unreservedly despite his coercive and tyrannical methods.
The British supported the Pahlavi regime and certainly were very involved in backing Mohammad Reza Shah's claim to the throne of Iran and to a kind of absolute monarchy on the basis that he more effectively represented Western interests in Iran.
Britain was certainly a supporter of the Shah, as was virtually every other Western country in the period when he was on the peacock throne. The British saw him as the guarantor of stability in the Gulf. Everybody remembers the phrase, the policeman of the Gulf. Iran was an important market for Britain, for other European countries.
The Shah was the main ally of the West in the Middle East during a period where the fear of the West was the fear of the Soviet Union and the possible expansion of communism in different parts of the world. The Shah was obviously a bulwark of the security arrangements worldwide, but in particular in the Middle East of the West.
The British involvement in bringing the Shah to power and their sustained support made him a very close friend and ally. Nicholas Barrington was the head of the British mission in Iran immediately after the revolution. He speaks to us about how Britain struggled to keep the Shah in power.
People began to realise that the situation, the public opinion was growing up very much against the Shah. And I think the British, as far as I remember, were telling the Shah not to be too tough with these people. I mean, there were some around the Shah who said, let's, kill them all and so on, be too tough. And I think we were saying, be moderate to get someone, because it would be in our interest to have an Iran that was working smoothly of whatever political background with which we could trade and do dealings.
with the Shah in power, they're of course able to sell vast amounts of arms to him. Ultimately, the Shah ends up with, I think, more chieftain tanks than, in fact, the British armed forces possess. And so the British do, in that sense, have a kind of economic interest in keeping the Shah in power.
As the Islamic Revolution of 1979 gathered pace, Britain failed to understand the signals coming from Iran and continued to support the Shah until his very last days.
They undermined the religious leadership, especially Ayatollah Khomeini's leadership, and they didn't understand how they are important to influence the hearts and minds of the public opinion in Iran. You can see the British government were always relied on the reports of their ambassador in Tehran, Sir Anthony Parsons, and they thought the Shah is very powerful, and for the British interest is good to not criticize the Shah foreign policies and human rights policies because of keeping the business activities of British government in Iran.
I was a teenager. I didn't know much about Iran, but Iran was seen as a developing Western-style country. And people really closed their eyes to the fact that it wasn't remotely democratic. And of course, as the Shah got older and the internal difficulties he faced increased, then SAVAK, the secret police, became more and more unpleasant in their dealings with people to repress internal opposition. The great mistake that was made by British diplomats in Tehran and to some extent in the British Foreign Office was that they failed to read the signs of coming turbulence until it was too late. So they were briefing the British Foreign Minister until the last moment to say that the Shah would survive. I wasn't there, but it seems to me, looking at all the history of it, that it was perfectly obvious that this was a regime in its death throes, as we say. And it would have been far better if we and other friendly countries had said to the Shah, it is time for you to go.
It's well known, perhaps well known to people like me who are interested, that until 1978, until almost the last moment before the revolution, the British ambassador in Tehran described Iran as being a bastion of stability and that there was no prospect in view that the Shah would be overthrown. So they're not only supported the Shah until the very end, but they were also quite wrong about the balance of forces until the very last minute before the Islamic Revolution.
Being a close ally of Britain did not spare the Shah from their harm. In 1971, Britain orchestrated the independence of Bahrain from Iran through a survey of the Bahraini population.
Iran was defeated to approve his claims, his historical and legal claims to ownership of Bahrain. And virtually the British government deceived Iran on that. Iran, under pressure of international community, accepted the referendum in Bahrain, but the British government actually pursued the Al Khalifa clan in Bahrain to not doing any referendum and just had a very fabricated information gathering, and they called that referendum. That was a fabricated referendum, and Iran had to accept that, although it wasn't in the agreement of Iran and the United Kingdom. So Bahrain became independent, and Iran had to accept that, and Iran couldn't follow its historical claims on the ownership of Bahrain. And practically more than two-thirds of Shi'i original Iranian Bahrainis became under the control of the migrant minority of Sunni rulers. And that was the act of British government. And Iranians always thought that was the fault of the British to terminate Iranians' claim to Bahrain.
The arrival of Ayatollah Khomeini to the political scene after the revolution posed many challenges to the interests of Western countries and Iran.
When the Shah left Ayatollah Khomeini came, we had to work out how to get established relations with the new regime. And for a long time, all people around the world didn't know how to do that.
When the Shah was removed by the revolution, obviously that was upturning the whole security arrangements that the West and the United States had. So obviously that was, at that time, their initial reaction. I think the tragedy is that the West was not able to get on with the Islamic Republic, and relations deteriorated so much after that.
With Iran engulfed in difficulties after the revolution and defying Western hegemony in the region, some saw an opportunity to put an end to the newly established Islamic Republic once and for all. It was Iraq's ruler, Saddam Hussein, who took the initiative, starting an all-out war against Iran. A war that would become the longest conventional war in the 20th century. Britain, as many other Western powers, claimed neutrality during that war.
I was a member of the British government during the Iran-Iraq war, and our policy was to supply nothing to either side. And I was a minister, and we were always having to make marginal decisions about, you know, was a sailing boat something that had a military purpose? If someone wanted to buy a sailing boat in Iraq, could we justify that or not? You know, some of these decisions were not very easy, but I know as a member of the British government at the time, the attitude was one of studied, deliberate neutrality. But I know a lot of Iranians don't really believe that.
It was later understood, however, that guidelines had been established by the British government in keeping neutrality, but were not necessarily followed.
Having lost, as it were, influence within Iran, although, as usual in a post-revolutionary situation, it was very turbulent. I mean, you never quite know what's going to happen, because revolutions are chaotic. But Britain and the West really saw Iraq as a means of containing the Iranian revolution. And so a blind eye effectively was turned when the Saddam Hussein regime launched what amounts to an unprovoked attack on Iranian interests in the south.
I think it's quite clear that Britain, during the Iran-Iraq war, was much more supportive of Saddam Hussein than it was of the Islamic Republic. It professed, of course, to be neutral, as did many countries, but of course we know that in secret there were British weapons exports to Iraq during that period, something that wasn't clear at the time but came out later and was the subject of much criticism. And broadly speaking, it's no secret that Western countries supported either mostly passively, to some degree occasionally actively, the Iraqi war effort against Iran.
One specific case of Britain's active support for the Iraqi war efforts against Iran relates to the sale of British chieftain tanks to Saddam Hussein, a dispute which is still pursued by the Islamic Republic.
Chieftain tanks after the revolution again became problematic. The British government took the money many years before the revolution at the time of the Shah, but stopped giving them to Iran. Then, first of all, because of the revolution, they said, we are not going to give it to you, some of the magazines. Then after US embassy saga, they said, we are not going to give it. And then the third excuse was the starting of Iran-Iraq war. Okay, they said we have international obligation to not giving these chieftains tanks to Iran anymore. They took money, they should give the money back. They didn't give the money back. But at the same time, when the Iran and Iraq both had been sanctioned and they should be treated at the same situation, again with highest possible dishonesty, the British government already sold the Iranian tanks to Jordan and Iraq. and gave the Iranian tanks to Iran's enemy, although Iraq was under sanction as well, same as Iran in the war.
Documents suggest that not only did Britain resell the Iranian-owned tanks to Saddam Hussein, but also sent servicemen to Iraq in order to repair any damaged tanks.
They excused that we cannot help Iranian, we cannot give anything to Iranian, but practically they were helping Iraq for that. And you can see the documents on Chieftain Saga reselling the Iranian tanks who already been paid many years ago to the Iraqis and Jordanians, as well as repairing them in favor of the Iraqis in Iraqi land.
British companies were also involved in providing assistance to the Iraqi regime in order to produce chemical weapons. And this was done with the knowledge of the British government.
I believe that if you look at the list of Iranian complaints against Britain and other Western countries, I think the most justified complaint is indeed on that point, because it's not that long ago, the cost of that war was a terrible one, and there was a policy in the West generally, supported by the Israelis for their own reasons, that did tilt, certainly to use that word, towards the Iraqi side.
More than two decades after the war, the gridlock between the Islamic Republic and the West did not start to look less tense. The Iranian peaceful nuclear energy program caused even more tension between the two sides. With the absence of the United States around the negotiating table, Britain initially spearheaded diplomatic efforts.
What I can say, and it's very important to say this, was that the idea of negotiating with Iran over the nuclear dossier, rather than confronting Iran, was an idea which came from three European foreign ministers, from Dominique de Villepin, who was the French foreign minister at the time, from Joschka Fischer, the German foreign minister, and from me. And the Americans were not involved at that stage, and indeed elements in the American administration, like Don Rumsfeld, the defense secretary, were hostile to what we were doing. So sensible Iranians, including people like the now foreign minister Zarif Mousavian, and Dr. Rouhani, who was the man across the table from us, as well as Kamal Karazi, recognized that we were their three of foreign ministers, their best hope for solving this issue in a sensible way.
However, the attitude assumed in the negotiations by Europe, led by Britain, was at times even tougher than the American position, and aimed to stop Iran from pursuing any nuclear activity. This was accomplished by harsh sanctions against the Islamic Republic, adding fuel to the already antagonistic feeling of Iranians towards the UK.
نقش انگلیس بعد از آمریکا شاید در طول دوران طولانی 10 سال گذشته مذاکرات و چالشی که ما داشتیم با کشورهای غربی بیشترین بود، به خصوص در مقطعی که عملا با آمریکا مذاکره نداشتیم. مثلا زمانی که وزرای خارجه سه کشور فرانسه و آلمان و انگلیس در تهران بودن، اون جمله معروف جک استراو که در اون مذاکرات درخواست شد که ما اجازه بدید، خطاب به این وزیر خارجه سه کشور یا وزرای خارجه سه کشور آلمان و فرانسه و انگلیس، که ما 20 دستگاه سانتریفیوژ برای کار تحقیقاتی دانشمندامون داشته باشیم. از میون این سه تا وزیر جک استراو به صدا در اومد و گفت ما دو تا رو هم اجازه نمیدیم، و اینو در کتاب خاطراتش هم نوشته ایشون، و من هم در ملاقاتی که دو سال قبل ایشون به عنوان نماینده مجلس و رئیس گروه دوستی اومد به ایران و من هم در همین محل مجلس با ایشون مذاکره داشتم، گفتم آیه جک استراو این جمله رو شما هم در کتابتون نوشتید و هم در اسناد وزارت خارجه ما وجود داره. اون زمان شما با غرور این رو گفتید، ما امروز 19,000 سانتریفیوژ در سایت‌های خودمون نصب شده داریم. برنده این بازی کی بود؟ بازنده کی بود؟
While there were countries in Europe that did not want to wreck Iran-EU relations, countries like Germany, most of Southern Europe, the British were very heavily involved, and the British representatives in Brussels as well in the EU, they played a very effective role in the demonization of Iran and in creating hostility towards Iran among policymakers in the EU. And they did this alongside the United States. And of course, there were other lobbies such as the Saudi-Israeli lobby, but the British played a very effective role.
The sanctions created many difficulties for the civilian population of Iran, including access to important pharmaceuticals and medical equipment.
The lack of medicines, which I'm talking to people I know who have relatives in Iran, quite shocking. The basic inability, because of sanctions, to access Western drugs, pharmaceuticals, and Western technology here.
Sanctions, yes, were costly, created lots of problems for us, but they never be able to bring Iran to its knees. They wanted to impose crippling sanctions. It never worked. So I think it was it became crystal clear for everybody that Iran would never give up its rights because of sanctions, because of pressures, because of threats. And we were ready to stand for all of them.
Sanctions which affect the whole-scale population of civilians, it's a retribution against civilians, which after 1945, the Second World War, was made illegal. Now, I'm not a lawyer, but I think there is a case for saying the damage inflicted on a civilian population by these wholesale sanctions can be regarded as a crime against humanity.
In August 2015, the two countries decided to put aside their differences and their troubled history by reopening their embassies.
I'm proud to declare this embassy once again open.
But should historical events be addressed if Iran and Britain were to enjoy good relations in the future?
Following the announcement of the restoration of relations between Iran and Britain, the new Foreign Secretary, Philip Hammond, made quite clear that the British government, in fact, had no intention of acknowledging its role in Iranian domestic affairs over the past century. And I think there was a sense, from his perspective at least, that history was too fraught, perhaps, to delve into in any detail. But my sense would be is that he perhaps ought to acknowledge it.
بالاخره به ملت ما ظلم کردن قبل از انقلاب بعد از انقلاب تو قطعنامه تو تحریم تو ماجرای منافقین تو فتنه 88 میخوان چه بکنن در حضور مجددشون در ایران بالاخره برنامه وجود داشته باشه بنابراین اونا باید یه تصویر روشنی رو برای در واقع عملکردشون در ارتباط با ایران ارائه بکنن که بتونه قابل قبول باشه از نظر افکار عمومی ملت ایران
ملت ما ملتی است فرهیخته ملتی است هوشیار ملتی است هوشمند با درس گرفتن از تاریخ میخواد رو به جلو نگاه بکنه و دیگه البته یک آدم عاقل میگن دو بار از یک سوراخ گزیده نمیشه و دیگه سعی و تلاشش رو خواهد کرد که دیگه از این سوراخ استعمار گزیده نشه